A man is charged with beating his grandmother to death in Missoula. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has an update on flood damage done to the state capitol by a burst water pipe. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with a financial policy expert about regulating banks that are deemed too big to fail. A 25-year-old man is charged with deliberate homicide after his grandmother was beaten to death over the weekend in Missoula. Tyler Perry faces a deliberate homicide charge in the death of his 72-year-old grandmother, Carol Perry. Prosecutors say she was beaten with a chair while she lay on a couch watching television on Saturday night. Charging documents say Perry reportedly told a tow truck driver that he had to kill his grandmother because, quote, she had a third eye and was sucking the life out of his tyranny, end quote. He also reportedly said that, quote, everybody knew we had to bash her over the head, end quote. Court records indicate Perry had been living with his grandmother since hitchhiking to Missoula from Seattle at Thanksgiving.
And in other news from around the state, a bill by U.S. Senator John Tester to expand wilderness and mandate more logging on Montana federal lands will receive its first vote Thursday, more than 4 years after it was introduced. The vote, scheduled by the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, is a first step in the passage of the Forest Jobs and Recreation Act. If the committee approves it, the measure will go to the full Senate. Tester introduced the bill during his first term in 2009, touting it as a compromise between environmentalists and loggers. It stalled last year amid partisan differences and heated re-election campaign by the Montana Democrat. The proposal would designate hundreds of thousands of acres of new wilderness, plus set aside areas for logging and recreational use, such as snowmobiling.
Maintenance crews are still cleaning up the state capitol building after a frozen pipe burst and flooded the basement and first floor on December 5th. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us more about the damages.
Larry Strang owns the Politically Correct Cafe. It's in the basement of the Capitol building. The special on the menu today?
The Genesis 8 burger.
The Genesis 8 burger.
Well, Genesis 8 is part of the Bible where the floodwaters recede.
Spicy shrimp.
Marinated burger. Pepper jack cheese.
This is the first day the cafe has been open for a week and a half. Early on the morning of December 5th, a pipe broke in a heater at the back entrance. It sent water pouring for hours across much of the first floor, flowing down the stairs, running down the walls of the basement. When Strang came in on that sub-zero morning...
Well, it was just a disaster, you know. Water everywhere. They already had a lot of stuff torn up.
Tear sheetrock out and ceiling tiles and everything that got damaged.
That's Jay Scow. He works maintenance at the Capitol.
We're still in the process of putting it all back together.
The basement hallway is littered with tables, boxes, and equipment pulled from people's offices, including from the Montana Public Radio Capitol Bureau. That's down here, too.
Everybody's sorting out their stuff and seeing what got damaged.
The state does not yet have a cost estimate from the flood. Not all the bills have come in yet.
We had the costs associated with the company that came in and helped extract water, set up fans, dehumidifiers. We have mechanical engineers that were involved. We have our general services staff that were there.
Public Information Officer at the Department of Public Administration, Cheryl Olson, says the state is working with engineers to look at the backdoor heaters and try to think of ways to prevent this kind of thing from happening again. But getting rid of these water-based heaters would be tough.
It's a very large and complicated building. We can't really fix one small piece without affecting the whole heating system.
Other government structures around the Capitol had problems too, though none as severe as the Capitol itself. Olson says these kinds of things are just going to happen in severe cold snaps.
Cold weather is hard on all things mechanical, let alone all things living.
The flood was not severe enough to damage the structural stability of the building. Rooms and walls have been checked for moisture. Sodden, damaged sheetrock has been replaced to prevent molding.
But most importantly, nothing was damaged to the historic nature of the Capitol. Nothing was damaged as a result of that water flow.
Larry Strang at the Politically Correct Cafe says he lost a few thousand dollars being closed all this time. The state says he will have to look to his insurance company to find out if he can get that covered.
That'll be nice if, you know, we got it back and everybody isn't going to have a Merry Christmas.
Right now, he's just happy to be back behind the grill. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
Two new judges will be sworn into U.S. District Court in Montana this week. The addition of Montana Supreme Court Justice Brian Morris and Billings District Judge Susan Waters will ease a shortage on the federal bench. But their resignations from the state court system will leave vacancies at Montana's busiest and highest courts that will take at least 3 months to fill. Montana Supreme Court Administrator Beth McLaughlin said today that Waters' vacancy in Billings likely will be the first to be filled because it is the state's busiest trial court. McLaughlin says the Judicial Nomination Commission will select nominees from pools of applicants. Governor Steve Bullock will pick the new judges from those lists. The new judges will have to be confirmed by the Montana Senate in 2015.
Today's temperatures were a good 10 to 15 degrees above normal for this time of year across most of our listening area, and the National Weather Service says tomorrow could even be a touch warmer. But meteorologist Bruce Bauck says another cold front is just a few days away. Bauck says this very mild Pacific air mass has mixed out all that cold and in some cases dirty air that settled over the region. He says a very significant change to colder and snowier weather will move in from Canada late Wednesday into Thursday.
A lot of our areas will probably see temperatures warming to well up in the 40s, maybe even low 50s on Tuesday. But by Thursday, we're going to struggle to get out of the lower 20s. So it'll be a very big cool down for most areas. Yeah, this is an Arctic air mass that's going to be dropping southward into the region. It's not nearly as cold as the prior Arctic air mass that we saw those 0-degree temperatures. But it's definitely, you know, going to drop those temperatures, you know, on an order of 20 to 30 degrees as it pushes back down in the area Wednesday night and Thursday.
Bauck says some snow may be associated with this incoming system.
I think the amount of snow is going to depend on where you are. If you're up in Kalispell, you know, you could see 3, 4, 5 inches of snow. In Missoula, I'm thinking more like 1 to 2 inches at the most. Butte could see a good 3 inches out of this event.
The winter weather doesn't end there. Another system moves into Montana Friday afternoon into Saturday.
And that's going to produce widespread light snow across western Montana. Even Missoula could see several inches of snow with that. So that sets the stage that we could end up with a white Christmas. We think that it could warm up a little bit early next week and melt a little bit of snow, but the chances are now that we might see some snow on the ground for Christmas.
That could also complicate Christmas travel conditions. We'll have more on weather in just a few minutes.
A fifth-grade basketball tournament being held at the YMCA in Helena was canceled after police were called to break up a fight involving adults. Police Chief Troy McGee says his understanding is that the coach disagreed with an official during a game on Thursday and a scorekeeper got involved, followed by numerous spectators. The Independent Record reports the scorekeeper, Tanya Brandkamp, was cited for misdemeanor assault. McGee says more people could be cited. As a result, the YMCA canceled the rest of the tournament, which was to run through Saturday afternoon. Helena YMCA CEO David Smith says it was a difficult decision, but notes that when a parent signs their child up for youth sports, they agree to a 12-point code of conduct. He says violence and poor sportsmanship cannot be tolerated.
A new study shows the chamber of hot molten rock below Yellowstone National Park is more than 2.5 times larger than previously estimated. Lead author Jamie Farrell of the University of Utah said today the magma chamber is about 55 miles long, 18 miles wide, and runs at depths from 3 to 9 miles below the Earth. That means the supervolcano below Yellowstone has the potential to erupt with the force of its largest ever eruption 2.1 million years ago. Farrell says that eruption was about 2,000 times the size of Mount St. Helens in 1980, and a similar explosion would be a, quote, global event, end quote. Farrell says there have been 3 eruptions of the supervolcano, and scientists don't know when the next will happen. The BBC first reported Farrell's study.
The financial crash of 2008 brought increased scrutiny and louder calls for reform of the financial industry. Some of that has come to pass, but it's also true the financial sector continues to have tremendous influence over the government, which is its chief regulator. As financial policy advocate for the consumer advocacy group Public Citizen, Bart Naylor tracks that regulation and lobbies for stricter oversight of a financial industry he believes has too much power. Naylor is former chief and chief of investigations for the Senate Banking Committee. He's in Montana to give a series of talks, and he also sat down with our studios with news director Sally Mock. Naylor says although Wall Street still has a firm grip on Washington, that grip is starting to loosen.
case in point is the bank that was best regarded following the financial crash of 2008, namely J.P. Morgan. And Jamie Dimon, its CEO, was the best regarded banker. He was on top of things. He claimed they didn't need the bailout and so forth. Well, since then, Jamie Dimon lost $6 billion of his shareholders' money in a financial transaction that was too complex for him to understand. Initially, he dismissed it as a tempest in a teapot, and then after further review, described it, in his words, as an egregious error. The Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations of the Senate did an excellent dissection of just went wrong and found fraud in almost every point at which there should have been compliance, from the chief investment officer, since dismissed, who said, how about if we hide some assets by having a new math model that will sort of disguise the size? Again, all of this stuff is done with very complicated math, which is itself an issue that a CEO really can't understand what his quants are doing off there in London. To the board of directors, for example, there's a three-person committee at J.P. Morgan, as there should be, just assigned to risk. Well, those people themselves were not skilled in risk. Ellen Fuder, for example, I'm sure she's a highly intelligent person, but she's a history and art expert, and she's the president of the Natural History Museum in New York. Again, not a person well-equipped to look at the risk of J.P. Morgan. So again, the shiniest light in banking has now become the subject of public opprobrium.
There is, however, you would argue, still the attitude that there are banks and firms too big to fail, and you've even said they're too big to jail.
They're too big to jail. In fact, we're at the one-year anniversary of the de facto declaration of that we have unequal justice when it comes to these banks. Just to take us back, on December 12th of last year, 2012, the Justice Department brought a 17-page so-called statement of facts where they say, and HSBC, the world's third largest company by assets, admitted to numerous money laundering violations. In fact, $200 trillion worth. $200 trillion. That's a big number. I always like to think a million seconds is 2 weeks, a billion seconds is 30 years, and a trillion seconds is 30,000 years. We didn't know how to farm 30,000 years ago. So it's a very big number, $200 trillion. $800 million of that was specifically Sinaloa cartel money. But because the bank was too big to jail, in words almost like that, according to our attorney general, they instead were fined the equivalent of 1 month's profit, which is not nothing. But there is this immaculate conception theory of this crime that apparently there's a crime but no actual criminals. Just for context, that same week, a woman named Karen Gasparian in a corner check cashing store in Los Angeles was also found guilty of money laundering $5 million, that's M as in mother, $5 million, and was sentenced to 5 years in jail, as presumably she should have, but zero people at HSBC have been sent to jail. So they are too big to fail. We all bail them out. They are too big to manage. That is to say, Jamie Dimon apparently doesn't even understand what his quants in London are doing. And they are too big to jail. That is to say, our prosecutors, apparently fearing systemic tsunamis, can't actually bring fair justice.
You do support the Volcker Rule. And before we talk about why you support that, review for our listeners what it does.
The Volcker Rule is technically Section 619 of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Act, which Congress approved and the President signed in July of 2010, which essentially says this. Banks, you're getting basically cheap money from depositors who don't really care how well you manage the bank, because these depositors know that if you mismanage the bank, if the bank burns down with your paycheck still on the teller window, these depositors can be carefree about that because the federal government will pay them back. For the bank, that is a quite a temptation that you're receiving money. They don't look at how well you manage the bank. They don't even look if you're how risky you are. And so there is this temptation to take this money and make a quick buck, short-term trading, as opposed to the more patient, painstaking loan making, where you actually have to go out to the business, make sure it's a good business, and they are actually going to pay it back. The Volcker Rule says don't make those risky bets. No short-term trading. It's a step very close to what is known as Glass-Steagall, which was the 1933 deal that was fashioned. You get deposit insurance, but you can't engage at all in the so-called risky type of banking, known euphemistically as investment banking. That's the trading in securities and the underwriting of securities.
And the repeal of Glass-Steagall is in part ascribed to being the reason there was the big bank failures. And
yes.
So on.
Glass-Steagall was repealed piecemeal through regulatory fiat through the 1980s by the Comptroller of the Currency. That's the agency that oversees national banks. That's a bank that has the name NA after it. And then Congress essentially ratified and completed the deregulation in 1999 with the Graham-Leach-Bliley bill, which repealed Glass-Steagall.
You do think the Volcker Rule will in some ways impact at least what you call the casino culture?
It should. The rule itself is 71 pages long. It was issued last Tuesday by the five agencies, the five regulators that had to join hands and issue it. Public Citizen commented, that's us, and we were pleased to see that the preamble, the explanation of what they're doing in the 71 pages, cites Public Citizen 140 times. We think the rule could be tighter. So just to back up, Congress passes a statute, like here, drive safely, and here the rule is the speed limits. Okay, drive safely means 65 miles an hour on a straight highway and 55 it's curvy and so forth. It says in the rule that was issued last Tuesday, here's what it means to not do this high-risk trading. Yes, you may, quote, make markets, but we're going to be watching for you if you're building up a lot of inventory. If you're buying a lot of stock and not really selling it, we are going to be suspicious that you're not really just serving a customer who wants to sell with a customer who wants to buy. You yourself are engaged in the euphemism as proprietary trading. But it will be up to the regulators to actually pull the speeders off the highway when they're doing it. And that's possibly both the biggest weakness of the rule. There isn't really anything for the public to see. You know, when you're on a highway, you can see a guy that's going 90 miles an hour past you when he should be going slower. But with the prop trading, we really won't be able to see that unless there's another explosion, such as J.P. Morgan admitting that it lost $6 billion. I was just on the phone with the chief of enforcement of the FDIC, who very much said that. It's balls in our court. The reason that's a somewhat worrisome proposition is that we had a preventable crash in 2008. We didn't really need new laws to prevent that. We passed the Wall Street Reform in one sense to restate that you should not be doing this stuff, but the 08 crash was built on fraud and all kinds of reckless activity undertaken by the financial sector that the regulators should have stopped. So to say, all right, enforce the Volcker Rule, some of us are nervous that we still have sort of a Greenspan legacy of staffers that aren't really the tough cops that I think America deserves.
One final question for you, Bart. As someone who argues for government regulation and oversight and so on, what do you say to people who are so disgusted with what they see as a dysfunctional government right now? Like, how can you argue that a dysfunctional institution should be regulating anybody?
You raise a good point, and when I sort of step outside Washington, D.C., where I live and work, and imagine how I can't imagine why America would have any faith in at least what they see with minorities.
Less and less every day.
Yeah, yeah. And I think there have been some studies, for example, at the Federal Reserve, that morale even with the staff is quite low. I don't know the answer. This is a huge question. I would say that while certainly their standard government worker is not perfect, he or she has suffered over several decades of deregulation, of President Reagan, who said government isn't the answer, it's the problem. There were heads of agencies and banking agencies that would hold – and these are political appointees by conservative presidents. In some cases, Clinton put in some, I think, dreadful overseers who basically are saying we need to cut the red tape. So the cops actually – even the cops of good faith, at least in banking, had their own hands cuffed. They really weren't able to do the job. When I was the head of investigation for the Senate Banking Committee, it was during the savings and loan crisis, the agency sent 30,000 suspicious activity reports in. You know, a Montanan, Bart DeZebe, is the one who literally closed down Lincoln Savings and Loan. He literally is the guy that walked in the door and said, you know, you're committing fraud, and after several steps, he went to jail. 30,000 suspicious activity reports resulting in almost 1,000 bankers going to jail, one of whom was Charles Keating. Zero people have gone to jail after a fraud far bigger than the savings and loan crisis. And I think it's because the machinery of oversight has been dismantled and gutted in so many ways. So I think that Americans are right to be jaundiced about government, but and Washington, if you will, it's a big barn door at which to throw some mud. But at the same time, I think it's because our government overseers have not been fully equipped or enabled to do the job that I think Americans need them to do.
Well, have been speaking with Bart Naylor, who's a financial policy advocate for the consumer advocacy group Public Citizen. Bart, always a pleasure to have you in our studio and catch up. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Bart Naylor will speak at 12:15 tomorrow upstairs at the Union Club in downtown Missoula, and at 12:15 Wednesday at the Lewis and Clark Library in Helena.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be partly cloudy with some patchy freezing fog and lows 17 to 24 degrees. Tomorrow it should stay partly cloudy with patchy freezing fog in the morning and highs in the 40s. In central Montana, there's a high wind warning in effect from 3 a.m. tonight to 5 a.m. Wednesday for the Rocky Mountain Front, Eastern Glacier County, Cascade, Central and Southern Lewis and Clark, and Judith Basin County. Tonight should be mostly cloudy, becoming partly cloudy, with lows in the 20s. West wind gusts could reach up to 55 miles per hour, increasing to 65 miles per hour after midnight. Tomorrow calls for mostly cloudy skies with highs in the 40s. Expect southwest wind gusts up to 45 miles per hour, increasing to 55 miles per hour in the afternoon. And in southwest Montana tonight, expect partly cloudy skies with lows 15 to 25 degrees. Tomorrow, look for partly cloudy skies with highs 35 to 45 degrees. Expect southwest wind gusts up to 40 miles per hour. And now for the editorial comments of Tom Power.
The 20th century was, arguably, one of the bloodiest in human history. Just halfway through the 20th century's second decade, Europe organized itself into a relentless slaughter of an entire generation of its young men, as year after year they charged each other from sodden trenches just to be mowed down by machine guns. When they stayed in their trenches, distant artillery tore them to pieces or choked and blinded them with poisonous gases. It was called the war to end all wars, but now most of us cannot think of any justification for it having taken place. 20 years after the armistice that ended that world war, the Second World War was underway with violence on an even greater scale, truly global in the extent of the slaughter, ending with most of Europe in ruins and some Japanese cities transformed into radioactive wastelands. Separate and apart from World War II, there was mass slaughter as totalitarian political systems swept over a good part of Europe. Stalinism across the Soviet Empire in Eastern Europe and Asia, and fascism across a good part of Western Europe. Even when these empires were not actively at war, they were imprisoning and slaughtering their own citizens to eliminate all who were not pure in background and belief. The end of World War II did not bring stability to the world. The defeat of the imperial ambitions of Germany and Japan and the weakening of the other European colonial nations encouraged the push for political independence and self-governance in the former colonies and subjugated nations around the world. The United States and the Soviet Union saw these struggles as the new front lines in a Cold War between the two superpowers that had emerged from the Second World War. Backed by their threat to use their mindless stockpiles of thousands of nuclear weapons, the two superpowers fought proxy wars around the globe while the world waited for the assured mutual self-destruction that each of the superpowers had promised each other. Few expected the emergence of a nonviolent approach to political change to emerge from this century of global mega-violence and believable, if morally outrageous, threats of global nuclear incineration. But the global effort to repel both the Japanese and German efforts to build their new empires in Asia and Europe undermined the legitimacy of European colonial control over much of the rest of the world. Mahatma Gandhi, having been introduced to struggles for civil rights in South Africa, challenged British control of the Indian subcontinent. His primary tool was not armed insurrection, but a systematic challenge to the legitimacy of Britain's right to rule hundreds of millions of other people half a world away. He used European Enlightenment values against European colonialists, with powerful impacts both in Europe and in the colonies. With relatively little bloodshed, European nations ultimately surrendered political control of their colonies to indigenous populations. Nelson Mandela's struggles in South Africa can be seen as the second stage of that movement of indigenous people taking control of their own destinies. Bitter enemies who had threatened each other with vicious violence saw that the outcome of a full-scale civil war in South Africa could only produce a ravaged society and landscape that would impoverish everyone, both materially, culturally, and spiritually. Simultaneous with Mandela's release from prison and the end of the apartheid regime in South Africa, the Soviet Empire was dissolving across Eastern Europe and Asia. At the same time, the Soviet Union itself dissolved without hardly a shot being fired. In one Eastern European country after another, the communist regimes imposed by the Soviets lost power. The Soviet Union did not use its troops that were stationed in these countries to resist, and the secret police forces and armies of the puppet communist regimes did not use violence against their fellow citizens to try to save the communist governments that were being displaced. These were not just events in distant lands where citizens faced down morally unsupportable political arrangements and peacefully forced change. The same had been taking place in the United States. A century after the end of our own bloody civil war, ex-slaves were still not full citizens of this nation. The centennial of the Emancipation Proclamation was celebrated by American blacks in a nationwide struggle modeled on Gandhi's nonviolent approach for civil rights. The women's rights movement also surged to the forefront, and the struggle for gay rights gained momentum. Each of these relatively peaceful struggles within the United States, in its own way, has shown the power of cultural and ethical opposition to oppressive forces that seek to limit human rights, even when those oppressive forces are backed by the potential to use overwhelming state violence. In that sense, the end of the bloody 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century brought us proof that we can make moral progress, and we do not have to slaughter each other to do so. That is why Nelson Mandela was such a towering symbol of what is best in all of us, both in our friends and in our bitterest enemies.
Tom Power is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtvr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.